Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast, our last podcast of the year. Jamie is joining me. We have already dispensed awards and handed out various honors. We've toasted the six players who won majors in 2020 in this crazy year. We have bid farewell to the Bryan brothers. We've lamented the strangeness of this rotation around the sun. We have looked forward to 2021. So let's just kind of do an all-out wrap. Jamie, how are you? How goes in your part? Are you dusted with snow as we are here in New York?
It is a little bit more than a dusting here, but we are warm inside, staring. It's still coming down, but we are all good here.
I can always tell the rhythm of the tennis season based on emails and press releases I'm sent. And when there are no tournaments on the calendar, when there are no matches being played, they tend to get sort of increasingly distant from tennis itself. It's been a while since I've gotten a press release about an actual tournament result or a match result. So let's just kind of take final inventory of 2020, and then spin this forward to 2021. Are there any sort of enduring memory? If you were going to encapsulate this strange year in one image, what would it be?
In one image, that is hard. I would say if that was the case, an empty stadium, an empty arena. But I think for me, you did this a little bit in your mailbag, but I kind of have to agree with you that I feel like all in all, 2020 was terrible, of course, across the board. But for tennis, I do think that the sport distinguished itself in many ways. And I think that for a lot of the players that, you know, we have been talking about for years now, it was really nice to see a lot of those players break through in different ways. I think, of course, Dominic Thiem, you know, had finally won his first major, and, you know, he had a really strong year across the board. You know, 27 years old, finally gets to his high ranking, gets that major, and, you know, it's all done at that first tournament back, first major. We have Naomi Osaka, of course, who not only added to her major haul here, but then she found her voice and, you know, used it and used it well. And I think, you know, we can talk a little bit more about her, but you have Sofia Kenin, again, same thing, someone who we talked about who is young, and she, you know, kind of proved again that she is here, and, you know, she's 22 years old, but her first major win was not a fluke. And, you know, the list goes on. I think, again, these are players that we've been talking about, and it was good to see them all break through, you know, re-cement themselves and kind of redefine their careers this year in 2020, such an important year for everyone.
Can I give you my my off-court analog to that? I think we're all waiting to see which of these changes are stopgap. In that, just means, I mean this in life and not just in tennis, but which of these are going to be a new way of life? So are Zoom going to replace office? And are we all going to be enjoying outdoor dining going forward? And how much of this is just an emergency measure, and how much does this harden into our new reality? And I think in tennis, we have the same thing, that we haven't had a lot of match results. I'm glad you hit on the ones we did. And I think we did have some really good tennis, but I think a lot of the discussion has been about, how do we broadcast the sport? How do we travel? The Australian Open is going to have qualifying in Doha, and then charter private planes for everyone to then quarantine in Australia. And we have events moving, and we've experimented with different formats for tennis. And I think if any good has come out of this year, it has been that tennis has finally decided to innovate, to cooperate. It's not always been perfect, but I think there's been a real sort of spirit of enterprise that hasn't always been around in this sport. And some of this was necessity. Some of this was just trying to salvage events and put some money in players' pockets. But I do really hope that this spirit of enterprise, and we can do things a little bit different, and we can break some models, and we can defy conventional wisdom, and we can try and shift some dates around. And if Miami has to be played for 1 year in the Middle East, so be it. And if Indian Wells gets moved to October and everybody stops in the desert on their way to or from China, so be it. I hope that this is one of the legacies of this unhappy year, is that tennis has a lot more pliability and is a lot more nimble and has the joke of its flexibility on the court. It can do the splits. And I do think that if any good comes out of this year, apart from what you say, that the emergence of Dominic Thiem was great, and Naomi Osaka and Rafa and Djokovic, I mean, there were some really towering moments on court. But I do think, to me, one of the great sort of, I hope, enduring legacies of this horrible year is that tennis has proven that it's a lot more nimble than perhaps we thought and perhaps it thought. So I guess we'll sort of, you know, again, there's a lot of we can use that to transition to 2021. There are still a lot of unanswered questions about the schedule, about rankings, about where the Tokyo Olympics factor into this year that's already growing complicated. But I do think there was a real spirit of cooperation and of, I don't say ingenuity, but, you know, of enterprise that we haven't always seen in tennis. But before we spin to 2021, I do want to ask you, because you were so intimately involved in the Sports Person of the Year, the whole rollout that we did at Sports Illustrated. I think we talked last week or the week before about Naomi Osaka was one of the honorees, and Martina Navratilova wrote a terrific piece. I wanted to get your take on Naomi, the award, and sort of where you see her fitting into not just tennis, but the sports landscape, the sports tableau in 2020.
Yeah. So Sports Person, of course, we had five winners across the board, but it was great to see Naomi there, you know, another tennis player. We had Serena a few years back. So always great to see tennis players honored, you know, with our end of the year award. And the award's really about a mixture of on court, off court, you know, athletic achievement and sportsmanship. And that sportsmanship this year, of course, was very much focused on the activism these athletes were doing. And I think we've talked about this before, but with Naomi, the most impressive thing for me is just her maturity. I think you think back to, especially at the US Open, you know, when she, there was, you know, you think back to her essentially in tears on the court, you know, in the post-match interviews with Serena, and how that first major title for her was just so marred by that whole situation, and how she was very timid and unable to really express herself, and she was overwhelmed, and, you know, rightfully so. I think that contrasted with this year's US Open, you can just you really see the maturity. And you can really see, I think, you know, one of the phrases that Martina used in her piece was that she began to understand the power of her fame and of her platform. And I think that for me was the most important and the most interesting aspect of it all, is that, you know, that's something we don't really talk about. And it's something that, you know, her coach teaches her, you know, how to, you know, fix her serve and better forehands and backhands and fitness and all these things that are so calculated, but that's something that's really, you know, it's an intangible, and it's something that a lot of players, a lot of athletes across the board struggle with. You know, how do you manage this sudden influx of finances and the fame and, you know, people and cameras, you know, swarming you wherever you go, and the social media aspect. I mean, there's so many aspects of fame that we don't think about. And I think for Osaka to see her use her platform and grow and mature in such a, you know, quick way, and then to use it in such a striking way this year was just really remarkable. So, you know, like Martina wrote that, you know, she never asked to be in the spotlight, and I don't think she really ever enjoyed that. But, you know, winning those two US Opens, she kind of embraced it this year. And I think it was really, really great to see.
I think one thing that made it so powerful was that it wasn't performative, that you did not have a sense this was curated. Mm-hmm. This was just like, this is how I feel, and I'm going to act upon how I feel. Do you have any sense where this goes from here? I mean, I think that's one, you know, I mean, I think a lot of 2021 questions are sort of what's this going to look like going forward? And at some level, I think sort of the new Naomi Osaka, I don't know if you've seen the Vogue cover. I know there's a documentary being shot. I mean, this was not a one-off. I mean, there is going to be sort of some additional chapters here. Do you have a sense of what this looks like going forward? What Naomi Osaka, how she is going to present in 2021?
Yeah, I mean, listen, she's getting older, and she, you know, I think it was in May, she became the highest paid, you know, she surpassed Serena for the highest paid female athlete. I think she is going to continue to grow. And as you said, the fact that this has already been made something, I think makes it really hard to see where she'll go with this, you know, because this year seemed, as you said, just very natural. And I wonder if she feels now a pressure to, you know, speak up or speak out on certain issues going forward. So I think that's the biggest question will be how she's going to react to all of this, you know, especially on the court. I think, you know, this to me reminds me very much of Serena, you know, being put in a lot of different situations over the course of her career where she, you know, had to speak up, and she was also on all of these covers, and, you know, whether it was Vogue or SI, you know, she really was like branching out beyond just tennis. And I think that's where I also see Naomi Osaka heading, you know, into a place that's not just sports. It's not just, you know, it's not just Vogue. It's most likely going to be expanding her, you know, her business or whatever it is. She's really taking that next step that we've seen players like Serena or Federer take in their careers.
Well said. I mean, I think we should also point out that she was, at least that last week of August, she was responding to a specific event, mm-hmm. that being the shooting of Jacob Blake. So let us hope that we're talking in terms of a vacuum here with Naomi Osaka, and there are not similar real world events that trigger the kind of statement that she felt compelled to make in August. Let us talk about 2021, because I think it is already, we are in December, and yet we could already say 2021 is not going to be a bounce back to normal. There are still a few tricky hops here. Most obviously scheduling, the Australian Open now, it's official. They are 3 weeks, I guess you could say, behind schedule, that we're now starting February 8th instead of mm-hmm. the middle of January. There is, as I mentioned, there's qualifying in the Middle East for the Australian Open. There are events that are off the calendar. There are events that are shifting. There are a lot of restrictions. Someone sent me, I can call this up. I mean, someone sent me what the players got yesterday as far as quarantine and travel information, and the main draw singles entries get +2. The top 10 doubles entries get +2, and everyone else, the remaining doubles, the qualifiers, the wildcards, the lucky losers, they're all +1, which is one of those things that I think fans may not think about. For a lot of top players, that kind of a restricted entourage is really significant. And we can roll our eyes, and, you know, former players have sort of done, you know, back in my day, we traveled with a coach and only a coach. The fact is, in 2020 and 2021, that's not how players roll, and that's really a significant adjustment that maybe we're not considering sufficiently. I mean, it's just a sign of the times that the top players travel in a large group, and restricting that group really changes preparations and rhythms and approaches. I think it's going to be interesting to see which players choose which members of the entourage. I think we're going to learn a lot about players, and at some level it might be a bit of a stress test and an insight. What do they value, the physio over the coach? And I think it's going to be interesting to see who the hitting partners are. And I don't know if you saw this rule that when you commit to a practice partner, that's your practice partner for an entire week. So I think already it's been made clear that at least for Q1, at least pre-vaccine, it's going to be sort of more of the same in terms of scrambling and adjusting and right. a year like no other. What else are you sort of, I mean, if we spin to, I don't know, do this as a top five list. And I don't know, what else are you, what are the other storylines, themes, developments you'll be following in 2021, Jamie?
Yeah, well, sort of related to that, I think one note, with the first few weeks of the calendar settled in, you know, there's two tournaments in early January, you know, small ATP tournaments. You know, one here in the US in Del Rey, and then in Turkey. So for me, I think this, of course, is usually our tennis off season. I feel like it's a little bit earlier than normal, or it you know, it feels that way at least. But for me, I think it's a similar thing that we've discussed when we were, you know, everything was shut down during the spring, where are these players, how are these players going to manage the training and the preparation, and then sort of just jump right into the Australian Open? I think previously we saw a lot of players play, you know, they would take their off-season time, but then we'd see them in Australia in early January playing exhibitions or just tune-ups here and there, and that really set the tone for the year. Now, of course, you have players, as you said, who maybe didn't play certain tournaments, or they've been home for way too long. And so I think the way that the schedule is structured now, and as you said, the restrictions, I'll be really interested to see how players come into Australia, especially, you know, the weather a lot of times is a big factor as well in Melbourne. So all of those things combined, I think one of the biggest players that we haven't talked about all year, because he hasn't played all year, is Roger Federer. So he was the first one on my list as sort of one of my top storylines. And of course, this week we saw that he said, you know, at some Swiss event that he hoped he would be 100% by October, and apparently is still not at that point today. So he said that it will be tight for the Australian Open. So I'm interested, you know, he had the knee surgery, and then he went back and had something else done to kind of clean up something from that surgery again. So that was a little bit of a delay in his recovery, but he's one person that we obviously haven't talked about much. But you know, I don't know. What do you think? Is this concerning for you in terms of his career? Or do you expect him to just take it slow and come back and return to Roger Federer ways as soon as he's healthy?
Yeah, I think there are a few things going on. One of them is obviously the knee surgery, which I think it's pretty clear did not go as smoothly as planned, and he got a little bit behind in his schedule. Also, he tends to, I mean, he's talked about how sort of career extenders, one of the great sources of his longevity is the fact that he can take his whole family on the road and they enjoy traveling the world together. Right. In Australia, in many years, his parents come as well. So the whole family goes to Australia for January. That I don't think is going to happen. There are some exemptions. I'm looking at this Tennis Australia FAQ, and there are exemptions for children, but I think his children have already aged out of that. So I think it's a combination of his body, but also his rhythms and his traditions over the year. I think he also mentioned in that same speech that he's really targeting on Wimbledon and the Olympics. The Olympics are a whole other sort of segment of this that we can talk about. And I think we're obviously at the point where, and I think the same goes for Serena, it's very strategic where and when you play, and power to them. We never thought, you know, 10 years ago, we never thought we'd be having credible conversations about 39-year-olds pursuing majors. But here we are. And I think this is a happy development, but I think if things aren't 100%, you know, Roger Federer winning in Australia on hard courts after a layoff, best of five, that's going to be a tall order in the best of times. If anything is less than 100%, if he doesn't feel right about the family situation, if he doesn't feel right about logistics, I mean, heaven forbid if he doesn't feel right about his knee, it's probably not worth it. And I suspect, you know, I think most of the top, if you look at the fields for the US Open and the French Open, they've been pretty good. But this is post-reset. I think they were a lot stronger than people would have initially suspected. I think top players will play. Djokovic will be there. It looks like Nadal will be there. I expect Serena would probably be there. She also gets Olympia, I think, is exempt from her plus one. So Serena can bring her daughter. But I think better making it to Australia is probably pretty doubtful. And then, you know, who knows about Indian Wells? Who knows about these spring events? And then I think we're realistically
talking about,
you know, does he play the clay? But we're really talking about Wimbledon, the Olympics, the U.S. Open, and then you know, by the U.S. Open, he'll be 40 years old. So, you know, we can only see what happens.
Yeah, I think you raised an interesting point, though, and this is sort of related to Serena as well, which was you know, another name on my list here. But I think your point about almost it not being worth it, right? The interesting thing this year for me is the threshold for different players on whether or not, you know, it's worth it to play a tournament. I think in years past, we've seen Federer play and play through injury, play and pull out. We've seen other players do the same thing, you know, and it almost, if a player, a top player skipped a major without even trying, you know, you kind of knew that it was a serious injury. You know, it had to be a surgery or something that would truly prohibit that player, because we've seen the, you know, wrapped legs and ankles and arms and everything. And so I think for me, the most interesting thing is how these players determine the, you know, what's worth it. And it's sort of a, you know, they're weighing their bodies versus the prize money versus the travel versus the risk. There's just so many factors. And I think for Serena and Federer particularly, because of their age, because of their, you know, the time in their careers, the injuries that they have suffered most recently, their families, you know, the list goes on. That threshold is particularly interesting for me. And I think how the decisions they make in 2021, I wonder how much those, you know, will define how quickly or not quickly we see their careers come to an end.
Yeah, and I think also this period has really laid bare the range of economic status of these tennis players. That you know, at the top level, we're talking about people who have nine figures of net worth, and yet on this form from Tennis Australia, it has this inducement: if you don't take an Entourage member, you can get up to $7,000 Australian, so that's about $5,000 American, in the expenses that would have been dedicated to that person. So Tennis Australia clearly thinks that for some, and they're probably right, that for some players, an extra $5,000 is going to get them to change their behavior and change their traveling party. You know, $5,000 is probably not getting Serena Williams and Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal to do much of anything, honestly. So, you know, different players have different, you know, they're different decisions to make and have different needs. I think the Olympics we should probably touch on real quick, because I think it's as if 2021 needed more complication and but by the same token, more opportunity. Let us not forget we are now approaching an Olympic year with the cancellation of Tokyo 2020. So I think it's going to be interesting to see which players show up in Tokyo and how this impacts things as well. You yourself, Jamie, will be Tokyo bound, which I was happy to see.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, that's the thing. We don't know much about exactly how the structure will be and how things will be there. I think they're sort of figuring that out now. But as of last year, at this time, I was going. But I think you're right. I think the Olympics will be really important this year, as we talked about a little bit last year. But for a lot of players, that is just as important as those majors.
It's also going to be interesting to see how these Olympics, I think they will be held. I think, as I understand it, there are four different scenarios in terms of crowds and bubbles and protocol. Tennis players are ready to roll with this. I mean, most tennis players already have had the experience of playing a major event with no crowds. They've already had the experience of life in a bubble, of being tested. You know, a lot of other athletes that are going to Tokyo will not have had that necessarily. Let us, in these remaining few moments, any other thoughts going forward? I mean, we have a goat race that did not change much. I mean, Nadal obviously tied Roger Federer. Djokovic 3 behind, Serena Williams still at 23 majors. We have, you know, talented young players who now are at this, the inevitable step of can they do it again? Can they back it up? I'm thinking Swiatek and Dominic Thiem, among others. I think Sasha Zverev has a potentially interesting 2021 to confront. Any other themes themes or storylines you're looking to?
Yeah, I think one I wanted to mention at the beginning of our conversation, and this is along the lines of your off-court spirit topic, but I think one thing I was happy to see this year was so many people who I never even knew what tennis was actually started to play themselves. I think there was definitely a rise in people going out to the courts to play recreationally, and therefore a little bit more interest in the game itself, especially once the US Open returned and kind of was the first major back. I had a lot of people reaching out to me just to talk about it because they knew that, you know, I was involved with tennis, and I think that's really cool to see a lot of people getting out. Of course, it's a very good socially distant exercise. And I will say myself, I played more this year than ever before. And it was great. It was lots of fun. And, you know, it's challenging. It's great workout. And, you know, there's so many skills to learn. And I think it gives you an added appreciation for what these players are doing when you're out there trying to do it yourself. So my one, I guess, final thought for 2020, but then also looking ahead to 2021, is that I hope the social distance rise in tennis participation, if there truly is one, is good not only for, you know, fans, for the game, but also just for, young kids coming up and playing for future generations of pro tennis.
Oh, I like that. That's great. And I think you're totally right. I think, also, I've had a similar experience. I think I played when we were living in Connecticut for a few months. I bought, you know, $4 cans of balls, and that's about it. You go onto a high school court, and you'll probably wear out your shoes after a few months. But I think this is not golf, and this is not sailing in terms of expense. And I think that's something else that people discovered as well, that You can spend a lot of money playing tennis and go to fancy tennis camps, and also you can put on a pair of shorts and grab a cheap can of balls, and a $200 racket lasts you years and years, and it is not as prohibitively expensive as you are led to believe. I mean, yeah, there's a longer conversation here, but this is where the USTA comes in, and it's everybody loves the US Open, and that's what they're associated with, and it's fun to run a big event, and Jay-Z's in the stands, and there's catering, but really, this organization is also about growing the game of tennis recreationally. And I would say getting people to pick up a new sport, or getting people to play a sport more often, or finding kids and getting tennis into schools and youth programs is not as glamorous as eating lobster rolls in a suite, but that's really what tennis needs right now, more than this wildly successful annual event. In the limited time, well, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, I will say I waited on a lot of lines this year, this summer and everything to play. And I, the reason being was that there were a lot of kids out there with their parents or whoever, little kids hitting balls. And so it was really nice to see that. And I second you. We came across in one of our quarantine Costco trips a deep discounted Costco sized pack of tennis balls. So I'll see your $4 pack of balls and raise you a Costco sized box worth, which is now halfway done. But we also found it to be very affordable and just really fun to go out there and play when you really couldn't do anything else. So
Costco tennis balls sneak onto a high school court, or suddenly it's less than your, you know, it's less than Netflix. So real quick, I looked at the time. You and I both have 10-15 Zooms. So I will just say quickly, Mike Costa, who is a friend of ours, Jamie, and has been a guest on this podcast, has a terrific comedy special on Comedy Central. You should all watch it. He played at the University of Illinois for Craig Tiley, I will have you know, and then struck out as a comedian. He's on The Daily Show. He's very funny. He has an hour special. Go to the Hall of Fame website. It has, you know, they did not have an induction ceremony in Newport, so it has not been the easiest year at the Hall of Fame, but they have a ton of merch and some really cool online exhibits. Our friend Tom Rinaldi is leaving ESPN for Fox. We just hope this means he will somehow figure out a way to stay in tennis. Always enjoy his work and respect how he grinds his teeth when he's assigned to do pre-match interviews. Three RIPs that I wanted to pass along: Alex Olmedo and Dennis Ralston, who I believe played simultaneously in college, and Gordon Forbes, who wrote one of the great great tennis books, Handful of Summers, which I would encourage you to pass away. These titans of the sport pass away last week. We will keep the scheduling news coming as we get it. The ATP has put on their website the first 7 weeks of the year, weeks 8 through 13, which include, in theory, Indian Wells, which again, we are hearing is looking for an alternative time of year. Miami is still up in the air, and hopefully by Q2, when Pfizer and AstraZeneca and the like do their thing and we all start getting vaccinated, maybe things will optimistically resume some sort of normal. Anyway, it's been a strange year. Thank you, Jamie, for your we have not seen each other face to face in 9 months or so, but thank you as always for your collegiality and your support here. Thanks everyone for listening. We will continue this via Zoom, I suppose, into 2021. But everyone, have a good holiday. Have a good year. May next year be healthier and hopefully feature more tennis. Thank you.